Greetings, friends. This talk introduces the 6 weeks Truth of Happiness course Dhamma study on the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Included at the end of the talk is a 20-minute Shamatha Vipassana meditation session. This talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation. This talk was recorded in Frenchtown, New Jersey on January 5th, 2016.
Kind of a little late, but tonight I'll introduce next week's study, the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path. That's right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And again, I'll emphasize the use of those words. By inference, there's such a thing as wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong meditation. And so the Buddha was very specific in what he taught as a practice, as a Dhamma practice, as a path leading to a fully mature, fully awakened human being. I'll touch on a few of these things, and then I might develop one topic. It depends on how late it gets. So these are the words of the Buddha related to concentration. There are the four developments of concentration. There is a development of concentration that leads to a pleasant abiding in the here and now. There is the development of concentration that leads to the attainment of knowledge and vision. There is the development of concentration that leads to mindfulness and alertness. There is a development of concentration that leads to unbinding and the cessation of suffering. So he's taking us right from being a beginning meditator to developing this profound concentration. And again, remember that the Buddha taught everything, including concentration, within the framework of the Eightfold Path and in the context of the Four Noble Truths. So again, the point of concentration ultimately is to recognize and abandon all the causes of dukkha, all the causes of the unsatisfactory nature of life. And we're talking about here tonight how, as our concentration develops, we're able to not be so reactive. That's pointing to the last aspect of developing concentration, unbinding and the cessation of suffering. Everything the Buddha taught was in the context of the Four Noble Truths, and that's just a good example of it. My words, your thoughts and resulting actions, when mindfully observed, provide clear insight into your current state of understanding. As your thoughts, words, and deeds become more peaceful, your mind is naturally more peaceful. As clinging begins to diminish, a practice of developing heightened concentration becomes effective. Right effort is the first of these three factors of heightened concentration. So it's interesting where this falls in the translation, but this is also how the Buddha almost always presented the Eightfold Path, was in this order, beginning with right view, right intention, the virtuous factors. And now, after the Buddha has taught the importance of virtue, of moral and ethical behavior, and the reason for that, now he's saying you can take that understanding and you are ready to engage in right effort. It wouldn't have made much sense to begin with right effort when you don't have a context, would it? But now we do. Now we know what we need to do to engage in right effort, beginning with watching all of our thoughts, words, and deeds, because we now know that that's an expression of the present state of our consciousness or our mindfulness. And now the Buddha is teaching us how to engage, what right effort is. And again, by implication, there's such a thing as wrong effort. And wrong effort is everything else. So right effort is generating the skillful desire, actions, and diligence to avoid inappropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. What does that mean? It means to be mindful, to not let our minds, our thoughts, words, and deeds go back into what would be considered wrong speech, wrong action, or wrong livelihood. So right after he introduces that concept, he teaches us to be mindful of it. And we've talked about that tonight too. We're developing that mindfulness. Somebody said that they know restraint of words, holding your tongue. That's part of this. Abandon inappropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have arisen. So part of right effort is when we recognize that we're caught up in a wrong type of thinking or action, to simply abandon it. That's right effort. And every time we do that, we're engaged in right effort. Very simple, very direct. But we need that concentration to be able to see this, don't we, in ourselves? Or else we're just acting out of conditioned thinking. And we'll likely just go on defending our actions, no matter how hurtful they may be to ourselves or towards others. Another aspect of right effort is to develop appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. I know I say this often, that the Buddha, when he awakened, he knew how to think, but most importantly, he knew what to think about, what to hold in mind Remember, mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. What we hold in mind is going to determine our experience moment by moment. And so now we have a way of inclining our minds towards being an awakened, a fully awakened, fully mature human being. And the more that we can hold in mind these ideals and these concepts within the wider context, the more pleasant, the more peaceful, the more happy our lives will be. Again, that's the purpose of the Buddhist teaching. Another aspect of right effort is to maintain appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds for continual development of non-confusion and skillful qualities that have arisen. Just hold in mind these principles that we're developing. I'm not sure if I'm going to talk about it tonight, so I'll mention it now. Remember that also when the Buddha taught mindfulness, he taught the four foundations of mindfulness, and then he taught to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. In other words, when engaged in wrong effort, be mindful of that and enter and remain in right effort and all the other factors of the path. He explained it that way. That's the useful mindfulness or the refined mindfulness that the Buddha teaches, to be mindful of the Eightfold Path, because that's the path that will lead us to liberation and freedom. Right effort also refers to the practical development of the remaining two concentration factors of the path, of right mindfulness and right meditation. Right effort is developing a deeper understanding of the teachings of the Buddha. The implication here is that wrong effort is being distracted by activities or teachings that create confusion and further the establishment of ego-centered views. You are engaged in right effort in your study of the Dhamma. Right effort is the mindful effort to develop the entire Eightfold Path. These are the Buddha's words again. And I just said it. I shouldn't have said it. One efforts to abandon wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration, and develop right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right meditation. This is one's right effort. Everything the Buddha's teaching, he's pointing us back to the Eightfold Path. The right effort is to engage mindfully with all eight factors of the Eightfold Path. Any questions about where I'm at so far?
Can I ask you what you're reading from?
This is this week's article, and it's also an excerpt from the chapter that you'll be reading this week.
Okay.
Right effort also refers to organizing one's life for Dhamma practice. Organizing time for meditation practice and quiet time is right effort. Engaging in a meditation practice that develops tranquility and insight is right effort. Right effort is being a supportive member of a sangha that maintains focus on the Four Noble Truths. Developing the path to the cessation of dukkha is right effort. So the Buddha describes right effort very succinctly. Abandon what is unskillful, meaning craving and clinging, and develop what is skillful, the Eightfold Path. And then he says, if it were not possible to abandon what is unskillful and develop what is skillful, I would not teach this. If it wasn't possible to achieve the goal, the Buddha wouldn't even bother teaching. And remember I told the story about upon his awakening, the Buddha sat for two more weeks in meditation, not constant meditation, but he was considering whether what he realized, whether his understanding of dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths was something that he could teach, and then even at least as importantly, were people ready to receive it. And after a couple of weeks of thinking about this, he finally decided that if there were just a few people, and the words is often used, with just a little speck of dust in their eyes, meaning they're right there, they have an understanding, they just need a little bit more information. If there was just a few people with a little speck of dust in their eyes, it was worth getting off his cushion and teaching. And so he encountered quite a few people with just a speck of dust in their eyes, because he taught for 45 more years after that. If it were harmful to abandon what is unskillful and develop what is skillful, I would not teach this. So many of us, when we first come up against the implications of craving and clinging, we feel that it's hurting us in some way. We're going to might lose ourselves. And the Buddha was aware of this because he said this specifically to address that. If it were truly hurtful to let go of anatta, he wouldn't teach it. But he teaches it because it's absolutely necessary.
Can you repeat that?
Sure. You want me to go back to the beginning of it?
If it
often comes up in class that people say they can't imagine letting go of this ego personality. What will become of me? And even a lot of fear can come up around that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddha's addressing that specifically. When he says that what you think you are is anatta, it's not a self, let go of it. That's what he means. There's no hurtful consequence in that. There's only freedom. Mm-hmm. And let me go a little bit further. Developing the path leading to the cessation of dukkha is right effort. Oh, I'm sorry, I said that before. There's a task associated with each factor of the Eightfold Path. And I talked about this the last few weeks. So the task associated with this is to be mindful of wrong effort and enter and remain in right effort. So if you want to master right effort, that's the instructions right there. And it's all very simple, very practical applications. We can recognize when we're engaged in right and wrong effort and come back into right effort. And that's the teachings on all these factors of the Eightfold Path. I'm not going to read this whole article. For one thing, it's gotten a little bit late. But just to touch on a few points. Some of the things that I develop in this article are modern applications of mindfulness that are mostly helpful, but just to understand that they're not part of the Dhamma, and so they're not really a substitute. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be mindful in other areas of our lives, but as people developing understanding through the Dhamma, what we need to be mindful of is the Eightfold Path and, of course, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So that's your right mindfulness. And then the last factor that the Buddha taught, give me one second. Let me just read this in relation to mindfulness. And this is, again, the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness in relation to the Eightfold Path. So be mindful to abandon wrong view and enter and remain in right view. Be mindful to abandon wrong intention and enter and remain in right intention. Be mindful to abandon wrong speech and enter and remain in right speech. Be mindful to abandon wrong action and enter and remain in right action. Be mindful to abandon wrong livelihood and enter and remain in right livelihood. Be mindful to abandon wrong effort and enter and remain in right effort. Be mindful to abandon wrong mindfulness and enter and remain in right mindfulness. Be mindful to abandon wrong meditation and enter and remain in right meditation. So these are the tasks associated with right mindfulness, so just to hold in mind. And again, notice the use of the words right and wrong. This speaks to a lot of times the Buddhist teachings are presented for some reason as a non-dual teaching. And again, not to get into a long discussion about this, but non-duality is an aspect of modern Hinduism. It's called Advaita, and that's the basic concept of that. The Buddha taught very specifically dualistic, in fact, not dualistic, there's not even a right word for it, to be mindful of everything. And to very specifically be mindful when we're engaged in things that are wrong, that will lead to more mindlessness, lead to more suffering, lead to a continued establishment of an ego personality, rather than using the right aspects of the path to develop awakening. So understanding that there is a dualistic thinking is very important. We have to recognize that in some ways our thinking is fractured, going either towards awakening or towards continued delusion and suffering. And we have to be able to recognize it if we're going to change it. If we take on this notion that, well, everything is all one thing and there's no duality in the world, then why bother doing anything? If there's nothing dual, then there's no such thing as suffering. There's no such thing as delusion. It's all one thing. But the Buddha is saying, recognize it so that you can abandon it. Recognize those things that will keep you in suffering and having an unsatisfactory experience in life. And engage in those activities and that level of refined mindfulness that will lead very quickly to awakening if we engage in it wholeheartedly. So the Buddha taught one type of meditation throughout his whole teaching career. I've never come across anything else besides Shamatha Vipassana meditation. And he taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation as an integrated meditation. The reason why I say that is that there's some schools that talk about Shamatha or just calm abiding, or there's a big major movement called Vipassana, and mostly what they do is an analytical type called insight meditation, but often the shamatha part, the quieting the mind, is discarded. When the Buddha awakened, he awakened to the idea that we need to develop deep concentration. Prior to his awakening, the Buddha studied with some of the most advanced meditation teachers of his time, And he mastered those techniques very quickly, and he's just as quickly abandoned them. And both the two of these techniques are very similar to some of the practices that are around today. And the reason why he abandoned them, said that they weren't useful, is they didn't lead to the goal. They didn't have the capability to develop deep concentration within this wider framework of the Eightfold Path. And so the Buddha taught meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation, very specifically to develop concentration and not to have any type of mystical or magical experiences. He taught it as a very useful skill to be developed that supports awakening through the entire Eightfold Path. Any questions or comments? So after this talk, do you understand now that the Eightfold Path, we've talked about all eight factors of it, is an integrative practice that is founded in concentration, but that the other seven factors support concentration, and concentration supports the other seven factors. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. Is it? I mean, if not, let me know, and I'll try to explain it better. Because that's really the most important thing. The Eightfold Path itself, they're not difficult to understand concepts, are they? They're very simple and straightforward. The difficulty is that we have conditioned mind. We want to continue to defend and maintain this ego personality. And the Eightfold Path won't allow for that. So we have some resistance to it. And we tend to take things that we don't want to understand and make them much more complicated than they need to be. We'll apply aspects of anatta into the Eightfold Path when the Eightfold Path should be left free of any of those things. Just take it as it is and develop it directly that way. Is that clear? Good.
Just ask one question.
Sure.
By your ego personality, if you are not thinking about building your own ego or feeding off your own ego, is that what it's like not to have an ego?
Well, that's a good question.
Because I have little windows in my day when I'm not conscious. I'm not conscious with thinking. So I'm not drawing from my ego personality or trying to build into it. And I have times in my day, as I say, when I'm just not thinking about that. So is that the beginning of not having an ego personality? Or is it something, you know, then you get longer periods in your day that you can do without it, and is that how it works?
I don't know.
Oh. That's the question, John doesn't know. I've never heard that before.
But I will try to answer it. I really don't know, because there's no way that I can know what your real thought process is. So the only thing I can do is to provide the picture of someone who actually lived a life without an ego personality. And he looked like this. But he also spent the most useful life any human being ever did. The way to recognize that your ego personality is starting to diminish is that you are more peaceful in your own life, in your own skin. You're less agitated. Your relationships are more pleasant. Your overall life is better. Because the problem of an ego personality is it keeps us in constant, maybe a low level, but in constant agitation. It's always looking to acquire things. It's always looking to defend itself. So, and what we talk about almost in every class is the effectiveness of the Dhamma in minimizing those experiences, making life more pleasant and peaceful. Of course, the ultimate goal isn't just a pleasant and peaceful moment-by-moment life. It's to awaken fully and not be touched by any of this anymore. But that doesn't mean leaving the world. It just means we're awakened. So I can see that question comes up a lot in different ways, because we're looking for a way to understand, is this really working in my life? And the only way that we can know that is to take to it wholeheartedly and look at the results. And every one of us is talking about those results. And I know you have too, Lorna.
In my case, I get very happy. You know, I've mentioned to you that I get happy. I feel happy.
Yeah.
It's like an emotion. It's not something I need to hear a joke for, or, you know, something has to be good in my life, something good has to happen in my life. It's not, I just, it's a feeling of being happy, and just, I'm just happy.
Rapture.
Well, yeah. that's often referred to as one of the first jhanas, the second jhana that happens after meditation necessarily. You have these spontaneous internal experiences of happiness.
I don't think it's tied to meditation. It's certainly not time wise.
No, it's not. That's okay. What I'm saying. They're not like, okay, 10 minutes after it. It could be the next day or whatever,
yeah.
Or whatever. It's just these moments where
I'm just so happy. I'm very happy.
We're happy for you. Again, you're describing what should happen. You're describing the results of your right effort is happiness. But is it when the Buddha set out to teach, he set out to teach how we can be happy, how we can achieve and maintain happiness. Because what set him off on his search was seeing all the misery, all the unsatisfactoriness, all the competitiveness and aggressiveness in the world. And he says, I got to find a way to end this. For myself and for everyone else. And that's what he set out to do that, and that's exactly what he found, was a way of developing lasting peace and happiness. Hence the name of the book. You know, again, I talked about this, I think, last week. Buddhism is often presented in a general way as a very negative or pessimistic religion, and it's neither one of those things. It has to, the problem has to be first recognized if we're going to get to the solution. That's true about any problem. So the Buddha first described the problem, the general unsatisfactoriness of life caused by individual craving and clinging. And then he provided the solution, the Eightfold Path. One of the things that we need as part of that path is deep concentration. We've got to stop being distracted by all those things that lead to an unsatisfactory experience. We can't do it without that. You know, it's one important factor. And then the other seven supportive factors bring our mindfulness headed in the right direction. We know what to think and how to think, just like the Buddha. So you can look at the Eightfold Path now that we'll do the week on right effort, mindfulness, and meditation. But now you see that the whole path is about inclining our minds towards an awakened state of being. So the Buddha is showing you exactly how he did it. And if you do this, like he said tonight in the talk, if you do this, you will awaken. And anybody can engage in the Eightfold Path. One of the things that I touched on briefly is not to get distracted into other things. And the only point that I'm trying to make like that, about that, is if you're going to be engaged in a Dhamma practice, keep it on what the Buddha taught. And if you want to engage in other things, just recognize that those are other things. That doesn't mean that they're not worthwhile. It just means to be clear on what the Dhamma is. That's the refined mindfulness that the Buddha was talking about. When other people would try to, even during the Buddha's time, when monks and nuns would try to introduce other things, if the Buddha didn't felt that it ended up supporting the goal, he didn't allow it. He didn't bring it in. So it's just the way it is. This is the Dhamma, and other things aren't. But that's all that all relates back to right effort, just to be mindful of that. Again, it doesn't mean that you don't do other things. Nobody's going to spend 24/7 in meditation thinking about the Eightfold Path. If somebody told me they were doing that, I'd try to get them some help or at least stop them from doing it. Because that's not useful. We have to live our lives, and we have to develop the Dhamma within our lives. But just to be clear about what the Dhamma is and what it isn't. Because things can be, we can incorporate things into the Dhamma as part of wrong effort, believing that they're helpful, when really most of what we're doing is continuing to maintain anatta, where we're trying to lessen that and end the experience of anatta. Is that clear? Good. Any other questions or comments before we meditate? Okay. Yeah, we have a little time. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And Joni, I'll talk you into it. If you're sitting in a chair, keep your back straight but not stiff. Your feet should be flat on the floor. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, holding your back straight but not stiff. Your ear is aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel. And holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly, allow yourselves to settle into this room, settle onto your seats, settle into your bodies, and settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath and your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath and your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you notice that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. following a thought with a thought, remaining mindful of our breathing. If a persistent thought or feeling arises, stay with it for a moment or two, recognize it as impermanent, and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 5 more minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. And when you're ready, you could gently open your eyes. So are there any questions about tonight's class? Or any comments? You're all ready for next week? So this week, you'll read week 6, chapter 6, on right effort, mindfulness, and meditation. And then next week I'll be introducing anicca, anatta, and dukkha. That'll be a good one. Pardon me?
I said a vocab quiz at the end.
Yes. That would show if you really listen. So I'm going to finish by reading the Buddha's words on from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So you can, if you want to close your eyes and focus on your breath, that'd be fine. If you want to just listen, that's okay too. So this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects her life, her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again in this world. And that last line points to emptying ourselves of clinging to an ego personality. We're no longer attached to the world. So I think that's a pretty good sentiment to end on. So thank you all for being here tonight. Peace. Please tell Maeve I said hello.
Yeah.
And Happy New Year.
Congratulations on completing this week's Dhamma study. Remember to be gentle with yourself and enjoy your study. The most loving action we can take for ourselves and for all beings is to develop the Dhamma and awaken. If you feel that you would like to review any week's study or take longer than 1 week to integrate a lesson before beginning the next week's lesson, please do so. There is a lot to integrate. Continue to integrate your meditation practice into the broader framework of the Eightfold Path and the other supportive direct teachings of the Buddha. Keep in mind that this course develops the foundation for a lifetime of lasting peace and happiness. The continued development of these principles is based on your own continued right effort. Peace.